its property. So there is this question we must never lose sight of, civil society with its order of property and the other characteristics presupposes a certain concession to non-wise men. When we speak of wise, of reasonable men in legal language, see, this kind of reasonableness, for example, in watching when you drive a car, how are the chances, you know, that is of course not wisdom. That is a very low kind of reasonableness, which surely not all men possess, as experience shows every day, but which is not the wisdom of which we are hearing all the time. Eh? And this kind of wisdom, I mean, you can get an idea if you compare the notions of a very strict, for example, a very religiously strict man, yeah? Compared with what we as ordinary people think we can safely do. Yeah? Many things which are permitted by the law and many are encouraged by the law are not allowed from a very strict point of view. That is implied in the notion of wisdom. Therefore, all ordinary life, all political life, is already a concession to something unwise, to the highest sense of something unreasonable. These points are not developed by Cicero to the extent to which they were developed by Plato. And to which they, I'm sure, were developed in the Greek Stoic writers whose writings they have been lost. But we cannot understand Cicero if we do not think back of them, and especially since there are sufficient allusions to that. Now, we see, we find an other reference to this Platonic thought in the sequence.
Marcus, what are the many deadly, the many pestilential statutes which nations put forth? These no more deserve to be called laws than the rules a band of robbers might pass in their assembly. For if ignorance and unskillful men have prescribed deadly poisons.
Now look at this, I mean, that's an extraordinary, extremely formulation. After all, ordinary fellows who may not be very bright and thoughtful are for this reason not yet pirates or robbers. But from this highest point of view, because this question arises, the argument which is implied is this. Surely there are nice people, don't steal, rob, murder. But what is the ground of their property rights? The ground of what enables them to be free? You can say, well, if we go back to the past, and there we find that they were, as the Athenians, for example, said, that they were sprung from this soil. And there was no injustice in whatever involved in their living there, having their lands there. But who knows whether that is true, that the Athenians sprang from the soil? Is there not as likely as not there has been some form of conquest? So that these nice people are so nice because they are the descendants from conquerors, from Romans. This kind of difficulty, which is brought out in the most nasty way by Machiavelli, but which is brought out from a non-nasty way at all by Plato and by the Stoics, means this that the demands on justice and decency be justly made in ordinary life are not strict enough. That is the difference between Aristotle on the one hand and Plato and the Stoics on the other. That Aristotle on the whole leaves things at the commonsensical demand and the commonsensical understanding of justice, which Aristotle takes very highly, but it is still the commonsensical view which does not go into this disconcerting crisis into which Plato and the Stoics go. Yes.
For as ignorant and unskillful men have prescribed deadly poisons instead of healing drugs, these cannot possibly be called physician's prescriptions. Neither in the nation can a statute of any sort be called a law, even though the nation, in spite of its being a ruinous regulation, has accepted it.
No, that is strictly Platonic, as you would see if you would read, for example, Plato's statement. Now, law, if law is to be a dictator of reason, it has the same character precept by a wise man. They, in that field, there is a precept of a physician who dictates with a view to health what you should do or miss. Or take a farmer who has the art of farming, who dictates what should be done. But clearly what we ordinarily understand by a law is something different. The element of compulsion comes in. The element of acceptance comes in, however you will put it, and therefore say.
And that there might be an enforced love, such as a man might feel to an unnatural father or mother or country or the like.
Father man.
Now bad men, when their parents or country have any defect, look on them with malignant joy and find fault with them.
Yeah, but so they look at it gladly. Yes?
And find fault with them and expose and denounce them to others, under the idea that the rest of mankind will be less likely to take themselves to task and accuse them of neglect. And they blame their defects far more than they deserve, in order that the odium which is necessarily incurred by them may be increased. But the good man dissembles his feelings, and constrains himself to praise them. And if they have wronged him and he is angry, he pacifies
them. Again, repeat it, with his parents or the fatherland. Yes.
Parents and fatherland. He pacifies his anger and is reconciled and compels himself to love and praise his own flesh and blood.
Flesh and blood is a bit too strong, isn't it? Now we have another different case here, which is the most important, as we see. Here we have a good man who acts well. Who acts well, as we see. Knowing it, he knows how his parents and his father are now. But through self-compulsion. That's to say, we have here a case where a man does these things knowingly but not voluntarily, not gladly. Now what is this case? This action of this decent man is good if unpleasing. It consists in concealing his loathing, in compulsorily loving and praising. That's an entirely different case. In the two former cases, we had first someone acting badly under compulsion by fate. And then we had the case of acting badly under compulsion by ignorance. But here, there is no such compulsion, at least not visibly. Especially because there is no bad action at all. He acts well. That it is unfortunate to have undesirable parents is true, but does not in itself affect the moral character of the action, you see. This is a clear case of acting well and knowingly, which is not acting voluntarily in the sense of gladly. And we see here a kind of presupposition that the best actions are those which are done, which are intrinsically good and at the same time done gladly. Now, but why does this decent man who conceals the deficiencies of his parents or his fatherland, why does he do that? And what is his motivation?
Justice?
Yes, we would say, I believe, first today, but many same thing, from a sense of duty. But that is ingrained from justice. The right the proper thing to do. And you will see that he speaks also of the wicked would gladly accuse their fatherland. Whereas a good man would do it only with great misgiving. And even though he would not even openly accuse it, he would only, do that. The problem of the Krito is here to be, you know, it's present. One can here raise, of course, this other question. Does Socrates in particular hide the wickedness of Athens? In the Gorgias, he does the opposite. He brings out that all these great men, Themistocles, Pericles, and so on, not all, but this kind of men, that they are very bad, which is of course a slur on Athens. Now, we in the sequel, in the next few lines, we will get the solution of our riddle. But in order to understand it, that we appreciate these few lines properly, let us see whether the riddle is understood, whether the difficulty is understood. Mr. Levy seems to be on the verge of a remark. Did you not? Because we get through, all right. I have now a better judgment about what we can achieve or not achieve today than I had at the beginning of the class.
We live in a time when law is considered to be broken without much
there is, of course, a great difference between stealthily breaking a law, and openly breaking it because of its injustice. And the juster man would, I suppose, openly break it. If he breaks it only because of its intrinsic injustice. I mean, if someone makes a false tax declaration, also thinking there should not be such a terrible tax, that, of course, his justice might very well be questioned. And because there are other ways of showing that one disapproves of your task.
What about extremely unjust parents and fatherland? What do you praise, must be
done? That is a question of very great delicacy. And there are apparently some limits beyond which, well, let me put this, beyond which respect is no longer possible. And that is a very bad situation. But still, I would say the situation is different if the individuals concerned are one's parents or whether they are some other people, you know. But surely there is a question here. Locke discusses it in his way in the civil government, second part, when he speaks of the family. And I have stated this at some length in my chapter on Locke and natural history. I couldn't say it as clearly now, longer. But this is surely a question. I mean, the biblical commandment, honor father and mother, leads to difficulties in such extreme cases. And whether the fatherland has the same status in these matters, especially from a biblical point of view, with the parents, is of course a long question. But Socrates states it in the Krito quite clearly. If he had disapproved of Athens thoroughly, radically, he could have emigrated from Athens to another city. But by staying there, he admitted that Athens was at least tolerably good. And he had no longer this ultimate excuse, this
simple badness of the city. Now, but what is the problem in which we are concerned? Simonides is made to say that being good, i.e. always being good, is important. But one can, how good or bad a man can be depends on his fate. On his fate, and by this he does not merely mean social conditions, that goes without saying. He means at least as much the natural conditions. But the examples which we will see, which we are given to us, the man, the physician, who kills a man on whom he operates because he, the physician, suffers a heart attack while operating upon, there is no other physician around. Obviously, one cannot blame him as a physician for that. Totally beyond the country. And the other case where somebody makes, someone makes a does something wrong from sheer ignorance, then it's perfectly possible that it is, well, according to Socrates, simple assertion is always innocent, because in ignorance means here ignorance of the law rather than of that, he cannot be blamed for that. But here we have a different case, a case of the decent son of his parents or of his fatherland, who out from decency, from justice, conceals the defect of his parents or of his fatherland. And yet, of course, the whole thing is distasteful to him. Naturally. Where does the badness of the action come in? It's an unpleasant, unless we would identify the good with the pleasant. Hitherto we have not yet arrived to do so. Now let us read the secret to the next sentence.
And Simonides, as is probable, considered that he himself had often had to praise and magnify a tyrant or the like, not of his own free will, but by such constraint.
Yeah, but under compassion. Here we have the solution of the riddle. Here Simonides, a good man, acting badly, and knowing he knew that this tyrant was an abominable scoundrel, but not voluntarily, i.e. not gladly. Now, such a man can, of course, justly be blamed, in the language of our century, as a collaborator. Why did he do that? Praising a tyrant and others of the same stamp is simply bad. That he doesn't have the excuse which the son has, or the citizen of the country. The blamable badness consists in concealing the badness of the bad. He presents the tyrant as a wonderful man, and he knows that he is the opposite of wonderful. Now, what is the motive of Simonides and such like people in such like situations? He did it under compulsion. This is also,
maybe he wanted to make the tyrant become less bad.
Yeah, but the more obvious thing is, of course, what? I mean, we know a bit of how people behave under tyrannical government.
To refrain from killing Simonides.
Fear. Lack of courage. So this would indicate, at least, as we have seen on another occasion, that wisdom and courage do not necessarily go together, as common sense tells us anyway. But since we are here confronted with Socrates, Jesus, as the virtues are, all virtues are inseparable, this has a great weight. There is nothing, yes?
But is fear fear of the tyrant is only a lack of courage. There are certain things which come from fear. You know, they're gracious and they're rational.
Yeah, but must he out of fear do bad or disgraceful things? That's the question. So in other words, if someone runs away from a tiger, then he doesn't do anything disgraceful, he only does something reasonable. Yeah? But if he runs away from the enemy and he's a soldier, and the enemy may be much more dangerous than the tiger, the greater danger of the enemy is not excused. You see also that in this case, which is a decisive case, because this is a case where Simonides himself is involved, both. There is nothing of self-compulsion that he compelled himself. He was compelled by others, by the tyrant. Now, Simonides, surely, whatever the Spartans may have thought about it, regards wisdom as separable from courage or manliness, and so well it seems to agree here. Now there is something else involved which is more important. And that is that there is a difference between the good and the pleasant. What his son did to his parents was good, but very unpleasant. But this leads us to a distinction of two kinds of virtue. Those in which, generally speaking, the good is identical with the pleasant, and those in which, generally speaking, the good differs from the pleasant. Those, in other words, those virtues in which voluntariness predominates, and those in which compulsion predominates. I remind you of the emphasis put on compulsion and punishment in Protagoras' account of political virtue. And I suggest now this link up between what we are reading now and the context of the dialogue. See, think. Perhaps, so that it is inability hither to bring this identity is connected to the fact that these kinds of virtues are of a different kind. That one of them is essentially voluntary and the other is essentially compulsory. May I remind you also of the compulsory character of the whole dialogue. Sugar is compelled by Hippocrates, by his responsibility in regard to Hippocrates, by his justice, by his sense of duty. Yes.
I understand. You mean that justice and piety on the one hand are more compulsory than moderation and wisdom on the other hand?
From the Simonides' point of view, I think.
Well, can you really distinguish moderation in that way? I mean, you can say that.
No, well, there is another way of showing that, for example, from a different point of view. The virtues which have naturally pleasant consequences, and the opposite vices, naturally unpleasant consequences. You know, justice is more important here in this connection. The question of piety is only touched upon. And, you know, the simple example, if you overeat, there may not be any witnesses. You may be alone on an island. I believe it is connected with that. And now let us make a somewhat broader reflection at this point. Sugaris is engaged in a contest with Protagoras. What seemed to be a mere attempt to elicit from Protagoras some information about his curriculum and the theme for Hippocrates turned into a contest first photographer. Now here Sugarez vindicates Simonides' critique of Pythagoras against Protagoras' critique. But in doing so, he shows the difference between these two kinds of virtue. Now there was another difference between Sugarez and Protagoras which came to our attention today. Partly before. Sugarez stands for short speeches. Protagoras stands for long speeches. And we now have gotten a different indication from Sugarez's long speech about laconism. The difference is that between speaking disguisedly, as both Sugarez's ancestry and Protagoras' ancestry, and speaking frankly, as Protagoras claimed to do. Now the link up between the two points, I believe, is this. The question of how to speak, frankly or disguisedly, provides the example which shows the difference between the two groups of virtue. If we disregard entirely the consideration of justice, it is natural that to speak frankly, to say how you feel, that's a good thing. But then considerations of the feelings of others and so on, considerations of justice, limit what we can frankly do. Now, it would be good if we could complete our reading of this part. Virtue is knowledge. There is some agreement as to this between Sugarez and Protagoras and the Sophists in general. But the key point which Sugarez makes, the limited power of knowledge. Not merely with regard to seasons and tempests, but also and above all against the power of the unwise. This is Aristotle's diagnosis of the fundamental mistake of the Sophists toward the end of the Nicomachean Ethics, as the Sophists reduced political science to rhetoric, to the art of making speeches, because they believe that making speeches is enough for governing multitudes. Here at this point is where the problem of justice becomes acute for the wise men in the following form. How should they conduct themselves toward the unwise? Should they try to rule them? The Republic, philosopher king. Or should they accept being ruled by the unwise? It seems to be against nature. But if they accept being ruled by the unwise because of the manifest impossibility of the philosophers ever becoming king, that means, of course, that the question of how to speak becomes a key question. In the validity phrase of Mr. Cropsey, philosophy tempers its tongue and society stays its hand. That's a big deal. In a way, the biggest deal that exists. Good. Now let us try to finish this section where we left off in 46b8.
And he also wishes to imply to Pythagoras that he does not censor him because he is censorious. For I am satisfied, he says, when a man is neither bad nor excessively foolish, and when he knows justice which is the health of cities, and is of sound mind, I will find no fault with him. For I am not given to finding fault, and there are innumerable fools, implying that if someone delights in censure, he has abundant opportunity of finding fault.
Yeah, let us stop here for a moment. One must compel oneself to praise. He does not say here to love the unworthy. One must avoid as much as possible blaming the unworthy or the unwise. Now Socrates begins to cover up the difficulty which he had laid bare. One must be satisfied with those who are good, that's to say, who act badly only if compelled to do so by hard luck, which is of course a very tall order, because how far does this excuse go? Yes?
All things are good with which evil is unmingled. In these latter words, he does not mean to say that all things are good which have no evil in them, as you might say, all things are white which have no black in them, for that would be ridiculous. But he means to say that he accepts and finds no fault with the moderate or intermediate state. I do not hope, he says, to find the perfectly blameless man among those who partake of the fruits of the broad-bosomed earth. I find it, I will send you word. In this sense, I praise no man, but he who is moderately good and does no evil is good enough for me who love and approve everyone. And here, observe.
You see, and does nothing bad. Not so. That's very, that's another great change which the word makes. Yes?
And here, observe that he uses the lesbian word, epinemi, because he is addressing Pity. I love and approve everyone voluntarily who does no evil, and that the stop should be put after voluntarily. But there are some whom I involuntarily praise and love. And you, Pittacus, I would never have blamed if you had spoken what was moderately good and true. But I do blame you because, putting on the appearance of truth, you are speaking inordinately falsely about the highest matter. And this, I said, Prodicus and Protagoras, I take to be the meaning of Simonides in this poem.
Yes, one must be satisfied with, meaning one must praise gladly, those who are good, i.e. who do nothing bad, which implies there is no necessity of man ever doing anything bad, contrary to what we have heard before. But one must sometimes praise and love involuntarily those who do bad things. Differently stated, one must sometimes act badly by praising and loving those who act badly. The case of legitimate acting badly is that of praising and loving those who illegitimately act badly. That's a complication. In this remark toward the end of this phrase here, this seems to me prodigal and brother. Said I. That is very emphatic to make clear that now Socrates is speaking. Whereas before, when he spoke of I, it was Simonides. This he reminds us of this. Now,
Hippias said, I think, Socrates, that you have given a very good explanation of the poem. But I have also an excellent interpretation of my own, which I will propound to you if you so desire.
Yes. Socrates had addressed only Protagoras and Prodicus. Protagoras because he had brought up Simonides, and Prodicus because he was a countryman of Pitagoras, the attack by Simonides. But he just feels left out, and he tries to muscle in. But a man with a much stronger muscle prevents it.
Nay, Hippias, said Alcibiades, not now, but at some other time. At present, we must abide by the compact which
yet
made.
Now, and moderately, now it is just. Yeah?
Now it is just to abide by the compact which was made between Socrates and Protagoras, to the effect that as long as Protagoras is willing to ask, Socrates should answer.
No, literally, if Protagoras is still willing to ask.
If Protagoras is still willing to ask, Socrates should answer. Or that if he would rather answer, then that Socrates should ask.
You see, this still willing is clear because Protagoras probably got enough of his affirmation. He turned entirely to his discomfiture. You see also that Alcibiades acts on behalf of justice. While usurping the place of chance, he decided that Hippias can't say anything. And he had no one has ever given him that authority. But we may also say, in justification of Alcibiades and Socrates' quasi love for him, that in acting so unjustly, he acts wisely. Yeah? Because it could be only a disturbance. So it is already clear from the last remark that the whole intermezzo in which Protagoras tried to assert his supremacy and was given the privilege of addressing questions to Socrates is over. So Protagoras completely defeated, and especially in the poetry discussion, on his own ground, because he said, I'm the big shot, and they didn't say that, but he meant it. That is my fault, and then it proved to be a great thing. But Socrates has vindicated Simonides' critique of Pitagoras by hook and by crook. That he has refuted Protagoras' interpretation and criticism of Simonides' poem. That is clear, Manon. And now he goes even further in the sequel, which we discuss next time. He turns now to attacking the very notion of interpreting and criticizing poetry. After all, it is Protagoras' criticism, literary criticism, as we might say, might have been bad in this particular case, but it might be in itself reasonable. Socrates does not leave Protagoras his last refuge. And then, at this point, the last section of the dialogue begins. The last section where, under the assumption that this is all proven, the status of the remaining virtue has to be taken up, and that is courage. If these four virtues are all identical with each other, can courage be left in the cold? Of course not. And this leads then to a new discussion, and with quite a few very amazing happenings. Is there any point one or the other of you would like to raise, Mr. Dryer?
You suggested that you brought out the courage was different from wisdom in the example of Simonides. Having to praise the tyrant. That seemed to be a slight, that was the third example in that section, that seemed to be slightly different from the case of a son having to praise bad parents or even a father. I wonder what the significance of that was.
The difference is this, and the obvious difference. Even today then, immediately based on our own experience. If someone is a collaborator, as for Kvitlinger he calls it. Something bad. But if someone defends his own country, his own people, against more or less just or unjust attack, it poisons the back up. He's a man.
Right. Why would
there be different? In other words, as Simonides, by living with the tyrant and enjoying the dishes, and the food, and the drink, and the monetary reward, and expose himself to justified criticism. A wise man doesn't do these things. But he was a very witty man and made jokes about it. And when he was asked, what is better, wealth or wisdom? He said wealth, because the wise are to be found at the doors of the wealthy, and not the wealthy at the doors of the wise. And this was the issue, but you know that he was a man of not of strict morality, to put it mildly.
Well, then maybe this placement by Plato, or by Socrates to speak, tempered a little bit the criticism that we might have of Simonides. So the previous two examples were more justifiable, you know, fatherland.
Yeah, obviously, no, I would say it is the only clear case of someone acting badly and blameless. Because the man who acts badly because of ignorance is not strictly speaking blameless. Then we will continue then. The straight leader.
Yeah. And you know, he said it's not too difficult to present an atrocious deed in a favorable light. Every lawyer, barrister does this. And the great historian can do it much more. So what is really, the only radical conclusion, of course, would be which you drew. Glory by itself means nothing. And the only help you have is, for example, if stated that it takes the master of those who know Aristotle. His glory does not depend on what any historian tells us. His glory is that we can ourselves judge whether he deserves fame or not, because his books are as restored, is in a way as present to us as it was to the people talking to him in his field.
Yeah.
That is true. It's a very important question of glory, and I'm glad that we had an opportunity to speak about it. But here we must simply take it, because, I mean, otherwise we destroy the whole argument if we deny all the premise. Yeah. Mr. Nathan?
What the neglected to the ancient religion, this not may have been inspired to accept the notion that the ghosts of the dead are gone. When the law was before that, but on the question of remorse, I would like to.
No, first I have to say something about what you said. The striking thing is here, there is nothing said about tortures or punishments after death. They are tortured while they live by their conscience. And after death, they have only infamy.
In 42, where I think that, which according to the law,
yeah, but there is nothing said.
And then these men were deprived of grace and the proper rights of burial.
Yeah.
Which implies that they would live on as fraternal servants.
Yeah, but that is really only that in the decisive statement made about the punishment explicitly, there is no reference to punishment after that. Yeah? What we just said. Yeah. And you wanted to raise another question regarding the morals. Yeah. Conscience, by the way, here the word conscience, conscientia, occurs in the original,
yeah,
as it did before.
But it occurs in the religion coordinately with fear, cupidity, and whatever they're doing, in other words, humanity.
Yes, this is also there.
Yeah.
Did not
and when they come down to the summit path,
This is not limited, it is wrong to take this only in the meaning of remorse.
Remorse is one of the things.
Yeah, but the question is also, surely from the point of view of a sage, the stupidity and the other perturbations of the mind of Al Capone, take a neutral example, Al Capone, something most kind of punishment. But the trouble is that he does not find it so much as a punishment. Yeah? You know? Because he has no awareness of the serenity of the state, and he takes it, he looks at the very much, he compares for the things of which he knows. The other people work hard, yeah? and the majority of men have no power and all that. And he believes in him, right? And especially he is a kind of king out of, you know, no one has appointed him, elected him, he hasn't inherited his office. He is a kind, by nature, he can command, and everyone trembles. That this is of course not universally true because there is still the United States government, and that is quite true. It is not a very thought out doctrine on which such a criminal acts, I'm sure of that. But it is, on the daytime known to him, the most desirable life. Mm-hmm. There must be.
He does not?
Yeah, on the basis of his limited knowledge. Yes.
Yeah, but I was going to say, is that this is all working here on an objective notion of happiness. That this man, however stupid and narrow his view might be, will never be truly happy. Okay? I mean, it's not just a question of himself thinking.
That's absolutely correct. But the question is, how this can, must he not himself become affected somehow if the natural law is to have sanction? You know, I mean, we must here make it, what would it amount to? There is an order of nature, and those who comply with it are truly happy, even if they are tortured and poor in order to know this. And those who do not comply with it are by this very fact unhappy, even if they believe to be happy. That would be the question.
Yeah.
But the question is whether one can so completely separate the objective from the subjective, differently stated. Whether it's not in the Greek notion of happiness also implied the element of pleasure. And, you know, and not merely the pleasure accompanying the act, but that the whole life conducted along these lines has this element of pleasure. And the reason why I say this is, when you read Aristotle's Ethics, he begins with courage and ascends from there to the other virtues and at the end to the theoretical life. Now, courage is that virtue where the act of courage, yes, the consummation of it, namely fighting, yes, fighting with the imminence of death, yes, is where there is the greatest reward of the inherent nobility and the pleasure. In the case of the other virtues, for example, if you take temperance, there is certainly a mild pleasure attending a moderate consumption of food and drink. Yeah, and if you take too little or too less, there is a way of there is this pain of one kind or the other if you do not live moderately, you see. And in the highest form, the theoretical life, the activity itself is intrinsically pleasant, at least in spite of the fact that, as Aristotle said, learning is painful, but the learning is only leading up to the art. Yeah? Good. You see, that consideration remains, whether the mere intrinsic nobility is sufficient for constituting happiness.
But it still does not destroy this other things. But I mean, to suppose the case is true that the virtue of man who lacks these other things, or who lacks the necessity to life, somehow can't be called a truly happy man, I don't know, but there are certain things missing. But to turn the case around, the man who has all the external does not have virtue, Aristotle will be judged to be more
than that. Not only Aristotle, we always say, a very rich and prosperous man who is an abomination of human beings, we would surely prefer a nice and sensible beggar to such a fellow with big cigar or whatever. I mean, that's clear. Yeah, but the question is not merely that of the nobility. The question is when we speak of law or of the sanction. And that, in, but I can. The future on the basis of the evidence here, because the infamy or the fame, and infamy is clearly something extrinsic to the nobility of the act. Yeah? Because obviously a man can commit the most noble deed and no fame or infamy can come of it because no one knows of it. Yeah? So one must not, The Stoic doctrine is, of course, particularly complicated because they deny the relevance of anything outside of the virtuous act itself, you know. But the Aristotelian doctrine, the Platonic doctrine, allows of an additional element. Yeah? Happiness is virtue plus something. This something is very small in dignity compared to the other, but it is not nothing. In the Stoic doctrine, it is nothing. And that leads to that famous rigorism and extremism of the Stoics, which is alien to Plato. But we may find some more. He takes it up a bit later. Let us see. On page 438, I think there is something. No, I don't think. Must have made a mistake. No, let us first go on very there. And let us read only the beginning and the end of the next paragraph.
In my proposition of the consecration of plants, I am continuing it with Plato, who expresses his opinion about the following of the debating
about the plants. Now let us skip that and read. His change at the end of his paragraph, this is changing.
These are his provisions. For mine, in other respects, I have not laid down such strict rules as this, out of consideration for the faults of men and the resources of human life in our time. But regarding the land, I am afraid this conversation will be fine if any superstition should grow up about the future suggestions of mine.
Yeah, you see here that only as a further illustration of the. A minor illustration of the deviation from Plato. Yeah? I mean, here Cicero is explicitly less severe, less strict than Plato, which makes great allowance for human vices, if you put it. I thought this should also be taken into consideration. Yeah, now here there is a difficulty which, Mr. Geyer, that was the point to which you referred, I believe, in your paper last time, yeah? That there is an omission here. Yeah, when Atticus interrupts here, as you see, yeah? The reason at the bottom of page 127.
You have given me a clear idea of the subject. Now the perpetual rights and the privileges and the gods of the lower world await. remarkable memory of yours, Pomponius. I forgot
this subject.
No doubt.
Now look at the end of paragraph 22, that's on page 399 top. Yeah? Where these are all the commentary. We are reading now Cicero's comments on the laws, which he stated at the beginning of the speech. Now it said, no one shall consecrate a field. The consecration of gold, silver, and ivory shall be confined to reasonable limits, which he had discussed. And then there comes the sacred rites of families shall remain forever. And according to Articles, this is the end of it. Yeah? You see, he says, that remains. No, I'm sorry. He adds also the rights of the gods of the lower world shall be sacred. Yeah? But the last point, kinsfolk who are dead shall be considered gods. This he does not refer to. The Articles does not refer to that.
He also leaves out Ivan.
Yeah, but that could have been an abbreviation because of what other sacred things have been mentioned. Now let us see that is a question of immortality. You see, what about the status of the dead people, that man especially in this case is that kinsfolk. What was your suggestion last time, Mr. Gaia, regarding this subject?
Well, I mean, this case,
yeah. Yeah, but it does not, that I believe it would not necessarily follow. I think it has something to do with the question of immortality. And since in this remark about the punishment, he mentions only the fame or infamy after death, and not punishment after death.
Is there a criticism of the view on grace?
Pardon?
This leads to a long discussion about grace in general.
Yeah, but that is, we have seen, that is in the Platonic Plato statement on grace is mentioned. No, I'm sorry, no, that was not about grace, that was about consecration of man. So,
are you pointing to the discussion that ensued between Aristotle and Cicero about burial rites,
is there any reference to immortality there? In this following paragraph, I do not remember.
No,
there's a mention of
it later on.
Oh yeah, there is a reference in the end of paragraph 68, but in a summary of Plato, yes, at the end of paragraph 68 on page 155 bottom. So. Yeah, but you said something last time about the problem of divine punishment, which I do not remember what you said.
Divine punishment?
No? Then we must take this out of another context. And then let us turn to book 3. Book 2 ends, and book 3 begins with references to Plato, and especially a praise of Plato again in the first paragraph of book 3. This we must, the law simply abounds with that, and that is in a way a part of Cicero's teaching, this admiration of Plato. We do not have to read that, but let us turn to paragraph 2, because there we have an explicit reference again to natural rights. Yes? As the speech of the
fourth,
you know, at the bottom of page 159.
What?
At the bottom of page 459.
Oh.
Beginning of book 3. Yeah.
You understand then that the function of the magistrate is to govern and to give commands which are just and beneficial and conforming to the law. For as the world governs the magistrate, so the magistrate governs the people. And it can truly be said that the magistrate is the speaking law, and the law of the magistrate. Nothing, moreover, is so completely in accordance with the principles of justice and the demands of nature, if I use these expressions, I would be understood that I mean law as is governed, without which existence is impossible for a household, a city, a nation, the human race, physical nature, and the universe itself. So the universe obeys God, these environments obey the universe, and human life is subject to the decrees of supreme law.
Yeah, well, what he, the subject of book three is the magistrate, which means the government. The government, especially the executive part of the government, as we would say in our language, that comes after the God. Now what he says here is then, says the principle that government, rule, in Greek arche, belongs to right, and to the, how does it say that, the demand of the constant, with a use, the conditio per natura. I believe that use also refers to nature, to the right and the condition of nature. We have seen statements to this effect in book three of the Republic. Government is in itself natural. There is a long argument in the first book of Aristotle's Politics, as you may remember, where Aristotle shows against some anarchists, as they would say, people who say that government is against nature, government is against nature, where Aristotle shows that government commanding superiority of and inferiority goes through every being, in the body, the soul is in command, and in both men and brute, and the phenomenon of ruling, of controlling, goes through all nature, and therefore in particular also regards in the case of man. Ruling is, nature itself is hierarchical, and therefore the human hierarchy is based on a natural principle. He mentions here four kinds of associations, as you will have seen. The household, the commonwealth, that would be the Greek polis, the nation or tribe, in Greek ethnos, and the whole human race. That is, you would find no parallel to that. In